verse in the Quran talks about to you your faith and to me my faith. And that when we are engaged with people of different religious backgrounds, that it's okay to say, you know what? You have your faith and I have my faith. That teaching for me kind of is comforting. It allows me to let me exist and you exist, each with our different faiths, with respect, with care, and with attention.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Can you remember the first time you went to a church or a synagogue or another religious meeting place for a faith different from yours? I'm a little embarrassed to say that I was about 14 before I did, and I remember looking up what Lutherans believed before I went with our small high school choir group to sing at their Sunday service. Our group included a teenage girl who was part of that congregation, and I guess I was expecting it to be super different from my own way of worship, but I realized during the service there was a difference between what people believe and how that's actually acted out. And I remember thinking that all of those people in that building were also like all the people in my own church. So in today's interview, we'll talk about belief, and we'll also talk about practice and lived religion. And I'm so happy to introduce you to Najiba Saeed, who I met this spring at the One America Conference. I was immediately taken with her energy, her deep commitment to her own faith, but also her passion for interfaith work. Najiba is the inaugural El Hibri Endowed Chair and Executive Director of Interfaith at Augsburg University in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's been a professor, expert practitioner, and public speaker for the last two decades, and she co-edited the book Critical Approaches to Interreligious Education. She's also been featured in the Los Angeles Times on NPR, PBS, and other television shows, and she lectures at major universities across the U.S.
The beginning of my faith history is I was actually born in Srinagar, the Indian side of Kashmir. We are between two nations, Pakistan and India. Muslims in Kashmir have been a minority in the state of India. So there is something to be said for practicing faith, being born into a faith community that for generations is a religious minority instead of being born, raised, and nurtured in a country where your faith community is in the majority. And I think that has been really the push for me to always engage in interfaith conversations. It has made me really interested in how religion is utilized for peace building or utilized for violence. And it's really helped me to think about what does it mean to be a person of faith, especially in a country that is trying to continue to be democratic and pluralistic. So what does it look like from the vantage point of a religious minority? What are the special roles we play as minorities? And, you know, what can we learn from that experience?
You know, I can't help wonder if being in Kashmir, really being on a sort of a borderline in between two countries. Do you feel like you've been your whole life kind of on the border between things?
You know, that's a really great observation. I definitely think I'm a peace builder because I'm Muslim, not despite being Muslim. Mm. And really part of that journey comes from the fact that what I found was really important in understanding the situation in Kashmir, which earlier in 2025, not that long ago, violence erupted again between India and Pakistan. And along that border, there is one of the highest military to civilian ratios in the world. So the stakes of thinking about the role of religion in promoting peace building and as an element for democratic pluralism have been so deeply ingrained into the story of where I was born, into my transition here in the United States. And I think one of the things that has been so important for me is to be able to really articulate the fact that spirituality and religion can be forces for peace building, connection, human flourishing, instead of very often, I would say, not just Islam, but religion in general is seen as a instrument and tool for violence, division, and inflicting harm. So I think there are multiple stories to be told about the role of religion in those kinds of conflicts, but also just in our community-based engagement in our own mosques, churches, and temples. How does religion heal?
This book you co-edited is called Critical Approaches to Interreligious Education. And even just very beginnings in a community where perhaps the Muslims and the Jews at the synagogue and Christians in their churches in one community don't really know each other, is there kind of a starting place to get that happening?
What's so fascinating about that book is it was actually a result of a multi-year project where we brought together scholars from Muslim, Christian, and Jewish backgrounds, and some scholars who were also well-versed in not just religion, but other areas. And the book became a product of that connection. And I think for me, what was really powerful, what the starting points are for having conversations, is to remember that we have to address what we call lived religion. A lot of times dialogue is very scripturally based. It can be very theoretical. Sometimes we bring together learned professors and clergy, and I feel like the discussion is here at the head level. And what I've found to often be the most useful kinds of conversations are those that look at, how do I as a Muslim live out my religion? I could pick up the Bible, whether it's the New Testament or the Hebrew Bible, I could pick it up and read it for days and assign my students 20 articles on Islam. But just one trip to a mosque or bringing in a speaker who is a practicing, you know, a rabbi or pastor, what they can share with that lived experience is profoundly instructive. And it's instructive not just about the facts and the beliefs of religion, but the emotional connection we have to the sacred. I'm always really drawn to hearing how people connect to what they consider sacred in their life, because that inspires me. If you're deeply moved to fast during Lent, if I'm deeply moved to fast during Ramadan, we don't have to fast during the same time or have the same belief, but we can inspire each other in the lived religion aspect of our lives.
I love that you bring up lived religion, because that's a way we can connect separate from beliefs. For instance, I could go to an iftar or breaking of the fast with my Muslim friends. I can attend the bar or bat mitzvah of one of my Jewish friends' children. And I can really take delight and learn from what they physically are doing and how they physically observe the traditions. In some ways, I can even join in. It's important, I think, to visit each other's religious spaces and each other's homes. I think that can really be unifying. I wonder if you have an example of people who were maybe at odds or at least holding themselves separate, began to find their way to unifying a community.
I remember a story, a mosque and a church that were both, people use the word conservative. I often say people that are tethered to their text, that are deeply engaged in their text, deeply connected to their text. Both of them felt that engaging in conversation with someone of a different religion for them was challenging, not because they were afraid of losing their faith, but they were so convicted in their connection to their own text, their own tradition. Instead of just bringing the two congregations together and having a conversation, the imam and the pastor decided that they would have lunch together once a month for almost a year. They modeled for their congregations, what does it mean to be in relationship with one another. They also did something that I think is really important, was that they prepared their congregations. So I often say what we talk or what we say about the other religion is as important as what we say when we're together. Before they brought people together, they were doing what we call religious literacy. They were teaching a Christian audience, what do Muslims believe? And they're teaching a Muslim audience, what do Christians believe? And I think that's really important, because what can happen is if we push people into interfaith engagement without that preparation, we may actually cause more harm than good. There's a scholar, a Catholic scholar, actually, Marianne Moyart, and she says, when we come together across difference, and I would venture to say this is not just religious difference, but ideological differences, political differences, we become fragile. We're a little bit fragile. We're a little bit more tender because these are things that are so deep to us, our ideology, right. Our religion, our belief system. So it's not always easy. We need to think about who we're inviting to the table, how we do the invitation, and that it's not just hospitality, but it's also the preparation before people come to a table.
We had an interview recently with one of the directors of One America. And at the One America conference, it was really brought out by one of the leaders there that they emphasize that the answers for how to do things in your community are already existing in each of the faiths. I mean, how you treat other people is actually prescribed in each of the texts of That's Judaism, true, yeah. Islam, Christianity, and other faiths too. So it's really interesting that when these divides happen, when there is so much fear, we're going against what we're actually taught and the solutions that exist within our own faith communities and our holy texts. You said something, though, that so many people kind of, I saw light bulbs going on and they all turned around to say, who said that? And it was when you said, some of my hardest work is not interfaith community building, but intrafaith, where within one congregation, people are thinking two different ways. And maybe even, would you say, judging them as like, we're the real Christians, you're not. We're the real Muslims, you're not. Is that the kind of divide you see?
I definitely think that one of the challenges of pluralism is not just the conversations across difference, but the conversations in which people share some aspect of belief. Because as you highlighted, a lot of times when we come to conversations around religion in general and spirituality and belief, and I would, again, extend that into ideology. It may not be a religious identity. It may be a political or ideological perspective. That one of the things we're really good at in the United States is debating. We're really good at contesting one another. Deborah Tannen has written about this idea of the argument culture, that a lot of what's happening in social spaces, whether it's public square or other spaces, is really much more focused on that debate and argument style. And I think there's a space for that. Look, I went to law school. My whole three-year education was based on learning how to convince the other side of my perspective. But you know, one thing I learned from a law school professor was she said, to be a good lawyer, you actually have to be able to have empathy and understand the other side, because then you create a much better argument. I was recently looking at the scholarship of someone who studied the Balkan conflict, and I was really struck by this idea. Paula Pickering has written about it, this idea that it's not just strong ties that prevent violence, but it's something called weak ties. We don't have to always have deep, connected understanding of one another and engagement that gets down to the depths of our souls. We also need to have weak ties. So it's fascinating if you think about that. What she was saying is, you know, are you engaging with diversity at your grocery store? Are you engaging with diversity with colleagues in the workplace? Those are weak ties, but they are actually really important for building a pluralistic society. One thing that I thought was really fascinating, there was a survey of synagogues that are healthy. And one of the indicators of a healthy synagogue was intergenerational spaces. It's wonderful to have a youth ministry, to have a ministry for, let's say, women and mothers who are working on whatever common issues. We spend a lot of time in our society building affinity groups. But what about intentional intergenerational spaces where people are learning together, having and sharing joy with one another?
Yeah, I'm thinking of, I remember my mother once saying, she was so puzzled. She grew up in a teeny farming town in Eastern Oregon. I think there were 300 people in the entire high school, and it was drawing from quite a wide area. But she said both the community dances and even church dances, and her parents were in the band, so they were always there keeping an eye on her and who she danced with. But she said everyone danced. And as a 13-year-old, she danced with other 13-year-olds and also 50-year-olds and 80-year-olds. And they were just always trading around. And she had that multi-generational experience of having had a fun social interaction with people of all ages in the community. And now those dances are all like, okay, this is the music of this particular generation. And, you know, ne'er the twain shall meet.
One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is where and how do we develop ties and have encounters that are very deep, very meaningful? And also, are we just in other ways, informally, spending time with one another. And the last thing I would say is we actually are losing spaces of pluralism. We're seeing a decline in certain religious spaces and communities. And it actually has an impact on political pluralism. Because when you went to your church on Sunday, you were sitting across the aisle from someone who may have had a very different political affiliation than you. You didn't know. Religion and religious communities actually are spaces of informal interaction for ideological perspectives that may be different. People are always looking at religion, sort of like as I was talking about the source of violence, they look at it as the source of difference. I also think it's actually, we're missing out when we see how religious communities are spaces in which ideological and political differences may have had a thriving intra-religious embodied kind of empathy.
The idea that you would know somebody and have had fun at a dance or a Christmas party or right. during a Ramadan iftar of someone that you were friends with, and then later you find out you think things different politically, you still know something about the goodness at their core.
I would say a couple of things that we really know that fear is based on the unknown. So it's really hard to fear someone if we get to know them, right? And the lack of knowledge about why someone is a certain way, why they're doing what they're doing, why am I dressed this way, covered? If you don't know why I am, then just that opens up the door to fear. So knowing more, engaging. I read an article the other day that more Americans are choosing to be alone at home. I'm sure the pandemic had a part in that.
Yeah.
But this isolation that we have, social isolation, and I'm thinking that we haven't quite addressed this epidemic. You know, some people have called it loneliness, but I would say it's even further beyond loneliness when people are choosing isolation or maybe it is imposed. And I do worry, you know, what that long-term impact will be on the mental health of individuals, but also on the public health of a community and safety over time. If we dehumanize each other, it really makes and opens up the space, whether the violence is interpersonal or it's more emotional and verbal, but I do hope that we think more intentionally about this reality of isolation. It's not just one kind of person that's becoming more and more isolated in the United States. Everyone, it's across the board. I have a friend who is a dean of spiritual life at a major university, and I asked him, what is your most popular class for freshmen in your university? And he said, it's how to make a friend. Like, wow. How do I make a friend? You know, extracurricular activities.
So basic.
Yeah, so basic. We are all making decisions and choices. Some may be imposed, but others may be by our own volition to be isolated. And what is going to be the cost of that?
Let me tell you about Kaboom, a thrilling audio adventure podcast made for the whole family to enjoy together. Whether it's a teleportation experiment gone wrong or an ancient Viking curse wreaking havoc on the high school football team, Kaboom has an adventure made just for you. With a new adventure every episode, you'll meet magical creatures, explore outer worlds, and maybe learn some valuable life lessons along the way. Subscribe to Kaboom on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with Najiba Saeed, Executive Director of Interfaith at Augsburg University in Minneapolis. Najiba, you work in everything from combating gang violence, different kinds of social justice in conflict resolution. Is there some overarching definition you would give to A, what you do, and then B, is that connected to your faith in some way?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I mentioned earlier, for me, I'm a peace builder because I'm a Muslim. One of the things that was so interesting to me is that I, at the age of 15, when I went to visit Kashmir for the first time and saw what are the realities of not just, you know, an argument, but the reality of what violence does over generations, I really made a promise to God that I would always think about peace building and especially connected to my spirituality. So to me, it was, you know, a covenant with God. So it's a very spiritual task for me. It's not just something I study. And part of it was my understanding and how I saw Prophet Muhammad, upon him be peace, as an example of someone who was a peace builder, It really helped me begin to see the stories of other prophets that are shared between particularly Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. You know, what does it mean when we hear that Jesus is sitting with the most outcast of society, with lepers? What does it mean to walk with people that are not of high social status? What does it mean when we see the story of Moses, of Musa, working, you know, with people that have the lowest status in society? And I think those stories are so important because what they do is they help us understand that peace building work is high risk. It means that you have to put yourself out there. You have to be willing. When you are going to walk with people, your own tribe is going to maybe pull back on you or push back on you. I have been most moved by people that show up for others when they get no benefit from it. And maybe not just no benefit, but they actually may suffer some consequences. And that to me is why I think faith is such an important element of peace building. And for me, not to say, okay, I'm doing this because I'm softening my relationship with the tradition or I'm diluting it, but what can I really do to deepen my understanding? And, you know, one of the people who taught me that was Glenn Stassen, who's since passed away. He was a professor at Fuller Theological Seminary. He would say, thicken Jesus, thicken the example of Jesus as a peace builder. Don't make it thinner. And so for me, what I would do is translate that into, okay, the spiritually authoritative prophet for Muslims is Prophet Muhammad, upon him be peace. So thicken his example. So now I'm actually teaching a graduate course in Muslim peace building to Muslim leaders. What we're doing is thickening the text, the context, the practices that support peace building, really indigenous to Muslim communities. And I would encourage whoever's listening, whatever faith background you're from, what are those examples from your text, your scripture, but also the practices of people who've been leaders in your community historically that have been examples of peace building? Because one of our problems that we face is so many of the people that we celebrate as peace builders are people that have passed away 20, 30, 40 years ago. The great heroes, you know, thinking about people that are celebrated like Dr. King, Gandhi, and others. I want to know who's the peace builder in your neighborhood? Who's the grandmother whose house, when there's gang violence, is a safe house for everyone? Who's the pastor that shows up when couples are fighting on a regular basis and is there to help heal those relationships? I mean, those are peace builders to me. Let's celebrate those folks in our local communities and amplify that kind of work, because I know it's hard. They're going to tell you it's hard. Might be nice to think of a way to celebrate our local peace builders.
Well, I love that. What a great suggestion. Now, you mentioned as a very young girl wanting to take on justice and peace building. Because that was an expressed desire, do you feel like God has opened the way for you to do that? Have you felt led throughout your
Absolutely.
Journey?
Absolutely. I work at, right now, a historically Lutheran institution, the first Muslim woman to get tenure at that institution. I was the first Muslim woman hired by Claremont School of Theology, which was a Methodist institution. So I have this history of being the first Muslim in multiple Christian spaces. What I've really been struck by is something that I call embodied pluralism, where it's not a theory of pluralism, it's not necessarily a deep belief in pluralism, it's really practical. I know how to be in a space that is Christian, but I also know how to be in a space that's secular. I know how to be in so many of these kinds of spaces, and we accumulate a lot of knowledge of how to be receptive, empathetic, sometimes to understand that in certain situations, giving people the grace. You know, maybe I'm the first Muslim you've ever talked to. I remember one university president that I worked with, he would say, you know, Najiba, this is a moment for double doses of grace. And he was a Christian university president. A lot of us talk about neighborliness, but what about teachings around grace and forgiveness? How do I work with someone that may have offended me from a place of understanding before I jump into a conclusion? And I would say, think about the combination of extending grace to others and then also holding them accountable by sharing with them how it impacted you, what it means for your community when that particular idea is perpetuated and shared, and what the impact has on you. Because I think that interpersonal storytelling is so much more effective than, you know, if I go to a group of people of another faith and I share with them statistic after statistic on how Muslims are treated in a certain situation, I think that's important. But if I can share with them stories on what does that do for a teenage Muslim kid in engaging in their religious tradition, when the only time I've talked to young Muslims and they say, well, the only time I really have turned sometimes to our religious texts is when everyone assumes we're violent. Mm-hmm. And my teacher is saying, why are Muslims so violent? Like, that's the inquiry. So that has an impact on young people when that's how they come back to their religious text. So just as an example, I think thinking about that idea of grace with accountability, and I do think that's what religious communities bring to peace building, is the ability to forgive, the ability to have grace, but also each religious community has their own contribution to that. What the Quran says is going to be different than what the New Testament says, is going to be different than what other sacred texts say. And I do think that is a reconciliation that we are able to produce in religious communities because of these experiences and teachings in which great prophets of so many religious communities walked with those that didn't have access to justice. And they did in ways that were inclusive of such diversity of their own communities.
Is there a particular chapter or surah in the Quran that right now is particularly guiding you or meaningful to you?
It's so fascinating because there's so many beautiful teachings on peace building. Let's talk. Let's have a conversation. Let's be engaged with one another. And at the end of the day, it's also God created all of these differences, that there is not just one religion, that people come with different religious beliefs. That teaching for me kind of is comforting. It allows me to let me exist and you exist, each with our different faiths, with respect, with care, and with attention to not wanting to unify, or I would say flatten, our belief systems, because that's another way that we actually can do violence to our belief systems, is by flattening them and asking everyone to come to one common denominator. And I don't think that's pluralism either, but that is a way that sometimes in interfaith conversations we may move in that direction. So I would just caution us to think about and engage not just in the practice of peace building, but to understand, I don't have anxiety over that difference. I don't have anxiety that you, yeah, Steve, have a different faith than I do. That's part of God's plan. After we have this conversation, you have your faith and I go off with mine. That's not just okay, but maybe that is part of the purpose of why we engage and learn from one another. I really think we need more spaces that are deeply generous and deeply gentle as human beings. I think we're really craving that.
Many thanks to Najiba Saeed for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, Ocean Marshall, and James Sturtevant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. And we have an occasional newsletter. You could sign up for that at ingoodfaithpodcast.org. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.